Martin King, as you know, for many years, was a Baptist preacher in the southern part of this country, and he was thrust into leadership of the civil rights movement at a historic moment in the civil rights movement and social change movement in this part of the country. That's where he has been locked in time, locked in a media image, locked as an icon in the brains of the people of this country. But Martin King had moved well beyond that. When he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, he became in the mid-60s an international figure, a person of serious stature whose voice, whose opinions on other issues than just the plight of black people in the South became very significant worldwide. He commanded worldwide attention as few had before him. As a successor, if you will, to Mohandas Gandhi in terms of the movement for social change through civil disobedience. So that's where he was moving. Then in 1967, April 4, 1967, 1 year to the day before he was killed, he delivered the momentous speech at Riverside Church in New York where he opposed the war. Now, he thought carefully about this war. He had been inclined to oppose it for quite a long period of time prior to that, 2-3 years prior to that, he had uneasy feelings. And I remember vividly, I was a journalist in Vietnam when I came back. He had asked to meet with me, and when I opened my files to him, which were devastating in terms of the effect on the civilian population of that country, he unashamedly wept. And I knew at that point, really, that the die was cast. This was in February of 1967. He was definitely going to oppose that war with every strength, every fiber in his body. And he did so. He opposed it, and from the date of the Riverside speech to the day he was killed, he never wavered in that opposition. Now, what does that mean? Is he an enemy of the state? The state regarded him as an enemy because he opposed it. But what does it really mean, his opposition? I put it to you that his opposition to that war had little to do with ideology, with capitalism or democracy. It had to do with money. It had to do with huge amounts of money that war was generating to large multinational corporations that were based in the United States. When Martin King opposed the war, when he rallied people to oppose the war, he was threatening the bottom lines of some of the largest defense contractors in this country. This was about money. When he threatened to bring that war to a close through massive popular opposition, he was threatening the bottom lines of what some of the largest construction companies, one of which was in the state of Texas. It was that patronized the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, and it had the major construction contracts at Cameron Bay in Vietnam. This is what Martin King was challenging. He was challenging the weapons industry, the hardware, the armaments industries, that all would lose as a result of the end of the war. Forget about democracy, forget about any ideology. This opposition to Martin King, this growing enmity to him, was based on money and the loss of money. The second aspect of his work that also dealt with money, that caused a great deal of consternation in the circles of power in this land, had to do with his commitment to take a massive group of people to Washington, and there to encamp them in the shadow of the Washington Memorial for as long as it took. For as long as it took, they would make daily trips to the halls of Congress, and they would try to compel the Congress to act as they had previously acted in terms of civil rights legislation, now to act in terms of social legislation. Now to begin to talk about a redistribution of wealth in this, the wealthiest country in the world, that had such a large group of poor people, of people living then and now, however, in poverty. That problem had to be addressed. And it wasn't a black and white problem. This was a problem that dealt with Hispanics, and it dealt with poor whites as well. And that's what he was taking on, and that's what he was challenging. And the powers in this land believed he would not be successful. Why did they believe that? They believed that because they knew that the decision-making processes in the United States had by that point in time, and today it's much worse in my view, but by that point in time, had so consolidated power that they were the representatives, the foot soldiers of the very economic interests who were going to suffer as a result of these types of changes. So the very powerful lobbying forces that had put their people in the halls of Congress and indeed in the White House itself and controlled them, paid and bought them and controlled them, were certainly not going to agree to the type of social legislation that Martin King and his mass of humanity were going to require. So there was a fear. What happens when they're frustrated? What happens when they don't get any satisfaction? What would happen, they feared, the military feared, was that there would be a violent rebellion in the nation's capital. And they didn't have the troops that could contain 500,000 angry, poor, alienated Americans. They didn't have the troops. Westmoreland wanted another 200,000 in Vietnam. They didn't have them to give to him. They didn't have them. They were afraid that mob would overrun the Capitol. They were afraid that what Mr. Jefferson had urged many, many times, that the body politic can only be cleansed by a revolution every 20 years. They were afraid that Mr. Jefferson would be listened to and that that revolution would take place. Because of that, those factors, Martin King was not going to be allowed. Not going to be allowed to bring that group of people to Washington. So, that's the reason for the hostility. He saw Memphis as part and parcel of the overall problem, as a microcosm. He saw the plight of the garbage workers here as being symptomatic of the pervasive sickness of American society. So he said, if we turn our backs on these ones, how can we go on behalf of the broad national interest? These ones need us now. Let's start the Poor People's Campaign here, which is what he did. Now, we move to the local conspiracy that related to the death of Martin Luther King. You've heard evidence of a very reputable 40-year business store owner sit up there and tell you that he always bought every Thursday. He went to Frank Bergo's warehouse. That was his last stop before he went back to Somerville. And on that Thursday, April 4, he heard the owner of that place take the telephone and scream into it, shoot the son of a bitch when he comes on the balcony, and then amongst other things. That's the first indication of the involvement of Mr. Frank Liberto, which information was given to the police and the FBI and forgotten about. Then you've heard two other independent witnesses testify at different ends of the trial. One called as a witness by the defense, Mrs. LaVeya Addison, who had this conversation with Mr. Liberto in her cafe. The Liberto leaned over the table at the time when the select committee hearings were on, apparently. Something came on the television and whispered to Mrs. Addison, I arranged to have Martin Luther King killed. She jumped back and was shocked. So Liberto puts himself in it against his own interest, mind you. He said that. I don't believe that. Then comes Mrs. LaVeya Addison's son, Whitlock Addison's son, Nathan, who confronts Liberto, and Liberto again confirms the same thing to him. So we see now Mr. Frank Liberto's involvement in this whole scenario. Then we have from the defendant himself. In sessions that are before you, and you've heard testimony from Ambassador Young and Mr. King about how he was approached. And he was asked to assist or become involved in this assassination. Again, by Mr. Liberto. And how he was told that he would be visited by a man called Raul. He would first receive some money, be visited by a man called Raul. He would pass the money to Raul. He would receive a gun. That he was being asked to participate in this endeavor, and he should not worry because there would be no police around. The police would not be there. We've heard him say that, in fact, he did these things, and that he received the gun after the shooting. He said he received the gun right at his back door. That's as far as he went in his admissions. He also, of course, said he didn't know what was going on. Neither Ambassador Young or Mr. King believed him in that respect. He didn't know what was going on. Now, why would anyone say this? Is this something new? No. You heard testimony from witnesses who indicated that Mr. Jowers had said this to them years ago, much as 20 years ago. He had said this. He had said that he knew how Martin Luther King was killed. He had indicated to them that he didn't do it, but he knew how it was done, and in one case actually told the same story way back then that he's telling now. So this is not some afterthought for Mr. Jowers to try to make a movie or become have notoriety or something like that. This is a consistent story that has been around for a long time, and other witnesses from previous times have confirmed it. So, other indications of the local conspiracy. Well, what are they? We've heard about the removal of Detective Reddit, who was a police officer on surveillance duty on the afternoon. He was removed within an hour of the killing, and told there was a threat on his life, and he was sent home to arrive at his home at the time of the assassination. Never to hear about this threat again. This was a phony threat. I think it became quite clear. They didn't trust him because he was a community relations officer, had been seconded into intelligence, and when it came to the last minute, they had to pull him off because he might have seen something, done something. It was untrustworthy. So Reddit was pulled off. The other officer remained just recording, making notes. He was a young officer, making notes of what he saw. There were two black firemen. Only two black firemen in the fire station, they were removed. They were given orders the night before not to report for duty, but to go to another fire station in each case where they were surplus to requirements. Why were they removed? Why were those two black firemen removed? Only two black firemen and the night before. You heard Jerry Williams, Captain Williams, testify that he had always formed an elite black homicide group of detectives as a bodyguard for Dr. King. The last visit, he was not asked to form that bodyguard. This was the only time he was not asked to form that bodyguard, and he didn't know why he was not asked to form that bodyguard, and that troubled him. You heard that the police were at one point around the Lorraine Motel, and then they were removed, or they just disappeared. They disappeared within a half hour, 45 minutes of the killing. Why did they disappear? Where did they go? You saw evidence that the Invaders, a local community organizing group that had been willing to work with Dr. King toward the end, that were there for the purpose of helping him produce a peaceful march. At 10 minutes to 6, 11 minutes before the actual shooting, they left the motel. They were ordered to leave the motel. They were told their bills were no longer going to be paid and they had to leave the motel. So they emptied up. Now, they might have reacted violently and caused some sort of conflagration at the motel, but they didn't. They didn't. They just left. You heard about the removal of the emergency TAC forces. This is the emergency TAC force. In this case, it was TAC 10, which was usually a group of four or five police cars with officers. The sheriff's department, police officers, they were the Lorraine Motel until the afternoon, before the killing, the afternoon of the 3rd, they were ordered to be pulled back to the fire station on the periphery. And when Inspector Evans, I was asked who gave him the instructions to pull him back, he said it was a request from Dr. King's group, and when he was asked who, you may recall, he said, ah, yes, I think it was Reverend Kyles who gave me that instruction. Whatever. But the attack forces were pulled back. And then you heard Olivia Capeling, who'd never been spoken to by anyone. You heard Olivia Capeling take a stand and tell about a man coming from an alley that was connected to a building that was attached to the rooming house. She saw this man coming through that alley shortly after the killing, some minutes after the killing, and getting into a 1965 green Chevrolet that was parked on Hewling, and then speeding away north on Mulberry Street, right in front of the police, burning rubber as he went, with no interference whatsoever from them. All of these things, all of these events, I submit to you profoundly strong evidence of the existence of a conspiracy just at the local level. Now, are we conspiracy buffs because we find all of this evidence insurmountable? I think not. But you have heard it. The masses of Americans have not, and the media has never put it to them, and I submit you probably never will. That's why your presence is so important. As we move into the next area, we're concerned now about a broader conspiracy. We move directly into the government of the United States agencies themselves. We have learned that the 111th Military Intelligence Group, based at Fort McPherson, Atlanta, Georgia, were here. They were announced. They had Martin King under surveillance. Eli Arkin of the Memphis Police Department Intelligence or Inspectional Bureau Intelligence Division said that they were in his office. He's admitted that they were in his office. There was another section here that was involved in covert surveillance of Martin King. They had Martin King's suite bugged, every room of it bugged, including the balcony. He wanted to speak privately and went out on the balcony. They would pick it up by relay from the roof. Then there were photographers. Remember those photographers that Captain Wheaton talked about? They were on the roof of the fire station. He put them there. And who were they? They were a psychological operations team. And they were there and they photographed everything throughout that day. That means, ladies and gentlemen, that there is a film of everything that happened, photographs of everything that happened, buried somewhere. We tried long and hard to unearth it, unsuccessful. But it's there, and it's hidden. As it was hidden from this jury, it's hidden from the American people. And maybe the media one day will let you know that it exists. They were what's known as the psychological operations team, and we know who the two members of that team were. So there is this very strong presence now, which is primarily surveillance, it's intelligence gathering, it's visual, and it's audio, and it's going on, and Martin King and his group are the subject of it. But then there's another group that's more sinister. They're not more sinister because of what they did, because they didn't really do anything. But we know they had a presence. And that was a special 8-man sniper unit that was here in Memphis. They were all part of the 20th Special Forces group. They were here, and they were assigned and they were trained for an operation, for a mission in Memphis. You heard testimony by a man who himself was a National Security Council operative, who was very involved in Iran-Contra activities, who had been a long-standing operative, if you will, of the government of the United States, and whose best friend was a member of that sniper team. There was no reason in the world for his best friend in a moment of whatever, anguish, burden, the desire to relate himself, to talk about this, talk about this mission that he was on, that he was assigned to in Memphis, which was aborted. So they were there, and there are three separate sources that confirm the presence. But they did not. It was not necessary for them to do anything. The mission was aborted because the mob contract was successful in killing Martin Luther King and framing James Earl Ray. We move to the cover-up aspect of this case. This, in many ways, is the most sad in a representative democracy, to have this kind of cover-up be successful for so long. It's a shame. I think it goes right to the essence of democracy and the right of the people to know. The cover-up activities in this case, ladies and gentlemen, range from murder to press manipulation and distortion, with bribery in between. Murder, unfortunately, in our view, and the evidence that you've heard here, credible source, is that a taxi driver who pulled into the Lorraine Motel maybe 6 minutes before the killing or so, shortly before the killing, the yellow taxi driver who pulled into that driveway, and who was standing at the rear of his car, loading the trunk of the car with the baggage, the luggage of someone who was leaving. Unfortunately for him, immediately after the shooting, saw the shooting and then turned to look at the other side of the road and saw a man come down out of the bushes and run up the street and get into a waiting Memphis Police Department traffic car, which sped away. And when he reported this to his dispatcher, he thought the police had the assassin because he was in a police car going away. Well, this man, as you've heard, was questioned by the police a couple of times that evening. He was to give a statement the next day. Didn't give a statement, did he? No, his body was found. Off the Memphis, Arkansas bridge, supposedly thrown out of a speeding car. Now, when we tried to find death certificates for this man, we could, either in Arkansas or in Tennessee, there was no death certificate at all. We found his phone number with that of his wife listed in 66 and 67. It was Betty and Paul. 1968, it's Betty brackets widow, W-I-D, for Betty. Widow. He was in, for him, the wrong place at the wrong time. And that's, in some ways, the worst of it. Because is there anything really worse than losing your life when you've been in the wrong place at the wrong time? Next aspect of cover-up is a tampering, drastic alteration of the crime scene. What happened there? You've heard what happened. 7 o'clock in the morning, Inspector Sam Evans called Maynard Stiles, who was a public works administrator, asked him to get a work crew out there to cut down those bushes, to cut the bushes down. Now, normally what one does with a crime scene, at least for quite a period of time, is to rope it off and keep people out of it and investigate it as it is. You don't go and destroy the crime scene. You don't know what's there. You go and you deal with it the way it was, is the time of the crime. No, it was cut right to the ground. Cut right to the ground. And however long it took them to do it, they did a good job. Because it was not possible for a sniper to be in that area once it was cut to the ground. Because he could obviously be very visible. So the image of a flat barren area is what was relayed, and that reinforced the whole bathroom window. There was no house-to-house investigation, ladies and gentlemen. Do you remember Judge Brown on the stand saying that this was the most deficient investigation criminal investigation he had ever seen as a criminal court judge. And he's talking about all of these kinds of things. Imagine, no house-to-house investigation. What that means is no policeman going and knocking on the door of all of the local residents and asking them, did they see anything? Did they hear anything? Because surely if they had, they would have knocked on Olivia Pakeling's door, wouldn't they? She just lived down the street on Mulberry. And she would have told them what she saw, but they didn't. They didn't do that. Why? Why did they suppress two alibi statements? A statement from Ray Hendricks and William Reed, who left Jim's Grill 35 minutes past the hour of 5, 40 minutes past the hour of 5, right around there. It could be difficult to pin the exact times down, but they left Jim's Grill, saw James O'Ray's Mustang parked in front of the grill, commented on it for a few minutes, and then started to walk up the street. But a few minutes later, as they had gone up a couple of blocks and were just about to cross Vance, one pulled the other back as the same white Mustang, so they thought it came right around the corner, driving away. As James O'Ray said he'd done. He'd always said he left the scene of the crime around that time to try to go have a spare tire repaired. And here are two alibi witnesses with statements given to the FBI. What about the death slug that was of known that could not be matched? You know, the media and the state have turned the burden in this case of matching the bullet to the rifle the other way around. They're saying because you can't exclude it, it may be the murder weapon. That's not the way it works. In any other case, that's not the way it works. This is not a good rifle in evidence when you cannot match the death slug to it. And it was a death slug capable of being matched. You have evidence that bullet was capable of being matched if it could. Enough striations, enough independent markings that they could match it. He talked about the numbers of actual agents who work for media companies, who are placed in positions, in network television company positions, in newspaper company positions, on newspaper editorial board positions. And if you see the history of how national security cases are covered, and this is one, you will be amazed that some of the most liberal columnists, writers, respected journalists, Pulitzer Prize winners, who have all the liberal credentials, when it comes to this kind of case, they all of a sudden totally with the government. Because national security cases are a different ballgame. Example, column 1, New York Times, November. The article is here. Alton, Illinois bank robbery. Wendell Rawls Jr. of the Times wrote this whole piece, fabricate, whole cloth, that the Ray brothers robbed the bank in Illinois, and that's where James got his money, and therefore there's no rival. The problem was that the article said that the Times had conducted a special investigation that paralleled that of the House Select Committee and that of the House Select Committee and that of the FBI, and all three investigations indicated this was the case. Case closed. This is where Ray got his money. Problem is, they never talked to the chief of police in Oklahoma. They never talked to the president of the bank in Oklahoma. There was no investigation. And when those people were talked to by myself or by Jerry Ray, who went down there to turn himself in, said, I'm charged. You think I did this? I'm prepared to turn myself in. The guy said, no, wait. You've never been a suspect. Isn't that amazing? Out of a whole cloth. But it appears, and that's the mindset that the people have. You heard Earl Caldwell say, he was sent to Memphis by his national editor, New York Times national editor Claude Sitton at the time, and told to go to Memphis, and his words were, nail Dr. King. Nail Dr. King. That was what he said he was told was his mission here in Memphis as a New York Times reporter. We could go on, but these are examples of what happens with the media. Now, Bill Schaap told you the impact of that, how the 31 years is very devastating. It's very hard to hear this 31 years and have somebody come along and say, you've been told the wrong thing, and here are a whole set of facts that are incontrovertible. And this is why you've been told the wrong thing. The reaction is still, well, yeah, that's interesting. But the next day, you still believe, because it's almost implanted neurologically. That's the problem, that this kind of distortion, media propaganda and use, just raises. Defendant's prior admissions, the next section of plaintiff's case. You've heard a good deal of it, how defendant has admitted how he was approached by Mr. Liberto, and how he was told that he would receive a package, which he did, some money, and eventually a rifle to hold. And he told about planning sessions in his cafe, and he told about taking a rifle from the shooter while it was still smoking. But he said taking it from his back door. And he named the shooter as a Memphis Police Department Lieutenant, Earl Clark, who is deceased, who was a sharpshooter, who he said was a hunting companion of his, a friend of his, and a friend of Liberto's as well, and who never had any contact with him again after this death. Now, Ms. Clark, the first wife, who testified, gave her husband an alibi. And it's only fair that you consider what Ms. Clark said. When I first interviewed her in 1992, she referred to that interview, and she told essentially the same story at that point in time. But there are serious questions with that story, and they have to do with whether or not, in fact, Lieutenant Clark had a radio at all at that point in time, and whether or not, in fact, Dent Cleaners was open later than 6 p.m. on that day. By her account, she got there sometime, could have been sometime around between 6:30 and 6:40 to pick up his uniform. Lastly, in respect of the defendant's situation, we had placed aspects of a woman's testimony into the record so that you can review it. And she was a waitress who had been a lover of the defendant during that previous year. She very reluctantly in 1992 gave a statement that had really to be worked out of her. She didn't want to tell this story even then because she was afraid that her former lover and boss, Mr. Jowers, was the killer. He was the only one she saw, she said, out there. And she was afraid that he was the killer. Plaintiffs do not believe that be the case at this point in time. But she described him running, face white as a sheet, looking like a wild man with all mud on his knees, as though he had been kneeling in that brush area. She has been, to some extent, discredited because there have been people have descended upon her for various reasons. And a statement of hers was taken, repudiating a lot of things that she said, but she subsequently said in another sworn statement that she didn't even read what the state officials told her to sign. So in a case like this, this is the difficult area for you to assess. You have got to understand the monumental importance of your decision. You're going to forget everything I've said, everything defense counsel has said here, everything the witnesses have said. They're going to remember one thing: the ruling of this jury, the verdict of this jury. Because you have heard evidence that has never before been put on in a court of law. Some of it would have been put on Mr. Ray's trial, if he had ever been granted a trial. It wasn't heard. Judge Brown was on the verge of granting that trial. On the eve, in our view, so close to granting that trial, and then he was removed by the Court of Appeal in this state from the case. Summarily removed without any argument. And your argument and made that decision. So Mr. Ray never had the trial. It was in his dying months when he might have gotten that trial. The Court of Appeal finished that possibility. Only you have heard this. People in the United States of America have not heard this. The masses of people in this country or the world have not heard this. They've heard snippets. They've heard edited clips on various documentaries and programs. But no one has heard the detailed evidence that you have. That is why your decision at this point in time is the most significant decision that will have been taken in 31 years in terms of this case. Please don't underestimate the importance of it. In our view, what has happened in this case, the injustice that has happened in this case, and it may be symptomatic of other cases. We don't know. We haven't gotten into them. We've just focused on this case. But what has happened here, in our view, is representative of a failure. Symbolizes it to me the failure of representative democracy in this country. Isn't that amazing? Why one could say that over a simple murder case. But when you look at the wealth of evidence that has come forward, you understand how this case has been conducted, and you understand how it's been covered up. And when you see how unresponsive elected officials and government has been, and how complicit they have been, can come to no other choice. Governmental agencies caused Martin Luther King to be assassinated. They used other foot soldiers. They caused this whole thing to happen. And they then proceeded with every powerful means at their disposal to cover this case. This is a conspiracy that involves, and that's a nasty word, people insult people in this country who use the word conspiracy. Nowhere else in the world, as Bill Schaap told you, is it viewed that way. In Italy and France, you know, conspiracy is taken for granted because they've lived with it so much longer. But remember that there were 39 daggers going into Caesar. You know, these things do not happen as a rule without the involvement of other people, and in this case, this type of murder, without the involvement of seriously prominent individuals in government. So, it is, in my view, a failure of this democracy and this republic that it has not been able to bring this forward. What we're asking you to do at this point in time is send a message. We're asking you to send a message, not just right or wrong. That's important, that you right or wrong, and that you allow justice to prevail once and for all. Let it prevail, let justice and truth prevail, else the heavens fall. No matter what, let it prevail, let it come forward, and we're asking you to let that happen. But in addition to that, we're asking you to send a message. Send a message to all of those in power, all of those who would manipulate justice in this country, that you cannot get away with this. Or if you can get away with it, you can only get away with it for so long. Ultimately, truth crushed to earth will rise again, and it has risen in this courtroom, ladies and gentlemen. Send that message. You 12, represent the American people. You are their representatives with respect to justice in this case. They cannot be here. The media will keep the truth from them forever. You represent the people of this land. You must speak for them. In all of my years, I have had confidence in one institution anywhere in the Anglo-American world, and it is a jury. It's 12 people independently come, hearing evidence and ruling. That's you. You have this duty to yourselves, this obligation to your fellow citizens, and you have an opportunity to act in the most significant ways that perhaps you can ever imagine. Because your verdict of conspiracy in this case, your verdict of liability for the defendant and his other co-conspirators means history is rewritten. Means textbooks have to be rewritten. Means the actual result of this case and the truth of this case now must come forward formally. And this message also will be sent to the Attorney General of the United States, whose team are investigating, in a limited way, they say, this case. You have heard much more. So that is why this message is so important. Please send it. On behalf of the family of Martin Luther King Jr., on behalf of the people of the United States, I ask you to find for the plaintiff. Find that conspiracy existed, and that those conspirators involved not only the defendant here, but we're dealing in conspiracy with agents of the city of Memphis and the governments of the state of Tennessee and the United States of America. We ask you to find that conspiracy existed, and once and for all, give this plaintiff family justice, and let's cleanse this city and this nation of the ignorance that has pervaded this case for so long. Let the truth reign in this courtroom once and for all. Thank you.
Black Op Radio presents Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, the DVD Complete Collection. Finally, the DVD set you've been waiting for is available. Over 15 hours with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Over 15 hours. Interviews with Len Osanek, John Judge, David Ratcliffe, and more. This is a one-of-a-kind set. These interviews feature Fletcher Prouty having candid conversations regarding his 23 years in the military, but specifically 9 years in the Pentagon from 1955 to 1964. His inside knowledge is invaluable to researchers of this era of American and world history. These are the revelations you've been waiting for. Over 15 hours with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, the complete DVD collection. Available at the Colonel Prouty reference site, www.prouty.org, and blackopradio.com. If you believe there's more to the JFK assassination and the mystery surrounding the CIA and its covert operations, you're not alone. Meet the man Oliver Stone called X in the epic motion picture JFK. Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty comes forward with never-before-seen or heard documentation and information about JFK, the Vietnam War, the CIA, and more on a brand new CD-ROM. The collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty is an incredible offer not to be missed. For a limited time only, find the answers surrounding these issues and more with the collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty. Call now at area code 604-525-4167. That's area code 604-525-4167. Or visit the Colonel Prouty reference site on the World Wide Web, the collected works of Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty.
Interviews with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, Secrets of the U-2 Flight. We are pleased to announce Volume 1 of Interviews with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty on DVD. This first one-hour DVD goes through the 1960 U-2 incident with Gary Powers. Colonel Fletcher Prouty reveals his inside knowledge of the incident, his office in the Pentagon, Operation Aquatone, Soviet overflights, and the similar Alan Pope incident. It is Prouty's position that the U-2 flight was sabotaged by the members of a secret team to stop the crusade for peace and embarrass President Eisenhower, thereby heating up the Cold War. And of course, Eisenhower warned everyone of the industrialized military complex that he had learned of firsthand in this incident. You will learn Gary Powers' U-2 never was shot down at 70,000 feet, as claimed in every single history book. Four separate interviews on one DVD, a one-of-a-kind must-have for anyone interested in finding the truth behind the cover story. Interviews with Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, Secrets of the U-2 Flight.